Well, Mrs. Lvovitz, she'd done a pretty good job. Mrs. Lvovitz thought, "You should only pass a turnip through the end of that which you have between the pants over there. Then we'll see who's done a pretty good job." But she took care to think it in Yiddish. Mrs. Lvovitz told Materia how blessed she was. "I love my boys, Mrs. Piper, but a woman wants a daughter." Materia didn't say anything. James said, "I love you, Materia." She said, "Badimut." He patted her head and gazed at the baby. "Kathleen," he said. Then, "Look, she knows her name." He had her baptized by a Presbyterian minister. "We gotta get a priest," said Materia. "It's the same God," said James. It was bad enough he'd had to go through the motions of conversion. He needn't subject his daughter to any Roman hocus-pocus. Mrs. Lvovitz looked after Materia and the new baby for the first 2 weeks. Benny said,
"You're interfering."
"I'm not interfering. She has no mother."
"You're not her mother."
"She needs a mother.
She needs time with her baby. How's she going to learn?"
James felt invincible. He charted the highest sales for 2 weeks running. He walked into the boss's office uninvited and demanded a raise.
"I'm afraid I can't do that just yet, Piper."
"I have a child now, sir."
"So have the other men. I'm worth three of those other fellows." "You've had a good couple weeks. Keep it up. You'll be employee of the month."
James turned on his heel, and it felt that good to walk out on the old man. "Let him try to replace me. He can't do it. It can't be done." James rode home high on his rickety horse. He was going to give that girl everything. She was going to grow up a lady. She'd have accomplishments. Everyone would see. He felt like a king. A sudden drop, and he was standing on the shore road, the horse dead between his feet. No matter. As good as a sack of money lying there in the slush, worth its weight in glue. He walked the rest of the way and formulated a plan. Pianos only needed tuning once in a while, but they needed playing much more often. And who plays piano? Country folk who learn by ear, thumping to fiddles and spoons for simple enjoyment, and the children of townspeople who want their kids to have accomplishments. The likes of those uppity losers he'd worked with at McCurdy's, not to mention the really well-to-do. Mr. James H. Piper, Esquire, offers tuition in the home to young ladies and gentlemen in the theory and practice of the pianoforte. He wouldn't bother quitting the job at the Sydney Post. He just wouldn't show. James arrived home in the middle of that day to find Mrs. Lvovitz in the kitchen, feeding his baby with a dropper.
"Where's my wife?"
"She's sleeping." He took the stairs two at a time and dragged her up by an arm, herded her down to the kitchen, whinging and whining every step of the way.
"Thank you, Mrs. My wife'll take over now."
Mrs. Lvovitz got up, thinking thoughts not in English, and left the house. James plunked his wife onto the chair and put the screeching baby into her arms.
"Now feed her."
But the mother just blubbered and babbled.
"Speak English, for Christ's sake."
"Ma bidr, biwajal." He slapped her.
"If she doesn't eat, you don't eat. Understood?"
Materia nodded. He unbuttoned her blouse. James allowed Mrs. Lvovitz over that evening when Materia hadn't produced a drop and the baby was fit to be tied. The women went upstairs. The howling the mother put up as Mrs. Lvovitz did the necessary. Downstairs in the front room, James unlocked the piano and played the opening bars of various pieces from memory in an effort to drown the sound. He'd have to invest in some sheet music and exercise books. His daughter would play. In a few days, the pump was primed and the baby was sucking. But the mother cried through every feeding. One evening in the fourth week of Kathleen's life, James snatched his child from the breast in horror.
"You've hurt her! Jesus Christ! You've cut her lip!"
For the baby's smile was bright with blood. Materia just sat there, mute as usual, her dress open, her nipples cracked and bleeding, oozing milk. James took one look and realized that the child would have to be weaned before it was poisoned. James might be a Catholic convert, but he'd never forgotten his Scots confession. Feckless Catholics believe in salvation through faith. Good enough, sit on your arse and believe all you like, but some of us know that work is the only sure bet, for the night will come, etc., etc. Get on with it, nothing will come of nothing. Within a month, James had enough students from Sydney to Glace Bay to start making ends meet. All day into the evening, every good boy deserves fudge and all cows eat grass. And at night, the staring zombie he'd married. Why had he married her? It was when he sat next to 12- and 13-year-olds on the piano bench and watched their eyes glaze over at the mention of Middle C that it hit him in the stomach that his wife had been no older than they. How had he been ensnared by a child? There was something not right about Materia. Normal children didn't run away with men. He knew from his reading that clinical simpletons necessarily had an overdeveloped animal nature. She had seduced him. That was why he hadn't noticed she was a child. Because she wasn't one. Not a real one. It was queer. Sick, even. Perhaps it was a racial flaw. He would read up on it. All Materia wanted to do was get pregnant again so God could send her a son. But there wasn't much chance of that because her husband wouldn't come near her. God would not give her another baby if he saw she was ungrateful for the one she had. So she prayed to the Blessed Virgin. She prayed in the attic because there was no church for miles and miles, and James didn't like her wandering anymore. On her knees, elbows resting on the hope chest. "Please, dear Mary Mother of God, make me love my baby." Kathleen thrived. Silky red-gold hair, green eyes, and white, white skin. Materia wondered where she'd come from. Surely she had been changed in the night. Mrs. Lvovitz didn't care to speculate. James watched Kathleen grow more beautiful and hearty every day. And what a set of pipes! He'd carry her out to the stony fields for yelling contests. They'd holler till they were hoarse and hilarious. He loved to hear her laugh. She could do no wrong. Feeding the child some lovely mush at the kitchen table, Materia leaned forward and cooed, "Ya helwi, ya albi, ya amar, te berini." The child smiled, and Materia said a silent prayer of thanks. Because at that moment she'd felt a faint breath of something not far from love.
"Don't do that, Materia."
"What?"
"I don't want her growing up confused. Speak English."
"Okay." A minor 49er. Kathleen sang before she talked. Perfect pitch. James was a piano tuner. He knew. His 18-month-old daughter could carry "Believe Me If All Those Endearing Young Charms" flawlessly, if wordlessly, after hearing him play it once. He sat perfectly still on the piano bench and regarded her. She looked straight back at him with adult gravity. It was a moment of equal parts anxiety and awe, like the striking of a wide seam of gold. The prospector sinks to his knees. He's only been looking for coal. At a gush of oil, he'd hoot, baptize himself, and buy the drinks. But the sight of gold is different. He observes a moment's silence. Then he rises, eyes watering. how to get it properly out of the earth, how not to be robbed in the meantime. Eventually, it would require real money. For now, he set aside his own studies and started teaching her himself. He read up on it. He bought a metronome, a gramophone, and began a collection of records. He ordered whole scores and song sheets from New York, Milan, and Salzburg. He decided it wasn't too soon to start on the Vaccai practical method of Italian singing. Mozart composed at 3. At 3, Kathleen sang, "Manca sollecita più dell'usato, ancor che si agiti con lieve fiato, face che palpita presso al morir." Materia was permitted to play piano again, this time exactly what was put in front of her. Scales, intervals, I semitoni. This lesson must be sung adagio at first, and the time accelerated to allegro according to the ability of the pupil. Syncopation, ornamentation, literal translation. The flame fails rapidly, more than usual, even if it flickers with a light breath. Appoggiatura, introduzione al mordente. The accacciatura differs from the appoggiatura inasmuch as it does not interfere with the value or the accent of the note to which it is prefixed. Intervals of thirds, intervals of fourths. Salti di quinta, salti di sesta. The little bird in a narrow cage. Why does one never hear it sing? Lesson 11. The shake. I would explain my anguish. Lesson 12. On roulades. I cannot believe my thoughts. Lesson 13. Per portare la voce. I cannot keep silent about everything. Materia played. Kathleen turned 7. Materia watched it all from a great distance. And as the years flew by, she missed her father more and more, forgetting everything but that he had once cared enough for her to find her a husband. All memories soften with age, and the good ones are also the most perishable. Her mother and sisters had long ago been caressed to disappearing soapstone, conjured up till they faded to nothing. Like cave paintings by candlelight, she could only glimpse them now in the dark from the corner of her eye. But her father's memory was durable. Obelisk eroded to a dome of rock, the touchstone of her loss. "You're too fat." Materia looked at James from afar and said, "Okay." He shook his head. Other men went strolling with their wives of a Saturday evening, took them to church on Sunday, sat at opposite ends of a row of children. But not James. He didn't want people thinking he'd married a woman old enough to be his mother, for one thing. But mainly, what with Materia gone slack in mind and body, he didn't want his child stigmatized. For on top of everything else, Materia was dark. He tried not to see it. But it was one of those things that was always before his eyes, now that the scales had fallen from them. He took Kathleen everywhere. They went on long walks, Kathleen in the beautiful English pram at first, and then hand in hand. Their walking language was Gaelic. With her fiery hair and fine deportment, people stared because she looked like a princess. Her clothes came from England. Nothing showy, all quality, like a real-life princess. And James trusted his immaculate shirts to no one but himself, shaved his face clean every morning. Together, they turned heads. It was 1907, and there was a town now. It had sprung up overnight, starting with number 12 colliery. Numbers 14, 15, and 16 followed in short order. The railroad came in, and so did the miners. At first, they came from all over the Maritimes, England, Ireland, Scotland, and Wales. In time, they came from everywhere. The Dominion Coal Company bought up land and built a sea of company houses. serviceable clapboard dwellings attached in pairs. There was a school, a Catholic church, Lvovitz's kosher Canadian butcher shop and delicatessen, McIsaac's drugs and confectionery, and the company store with enough merchandise to Mephistophelize a miner's wife. Every Friday night, the miners would hand over their sealed pay packets to their wives, who'd open them and fork over the price of a drink. The problem was, come Saturday shopping, the pay packet, with or without Friday's tipple, would barely feed even a small family of six. But the coal company had a solution to this. Company scrip. This was a form of credit. The missus could spend cash at those shops in town that stocked the odd item unavailable at the company store. And she could spend company scrip at the company store on food, shoes, cloth, and kerosene. Her man's sealed pay packet grew thinner and thinner, until quite soon it contained only an itemized account of how much rent he owed on his company house, how much interest he owed on his debt to the company store, and how much was still available to him in scrip to spend there. The company store came to be better known as the Pluck Me Store. Still, people poured in, filling up the streets that ran north-south and the avenues that ran east-west, every second one named for a Catholic saint or a coal company magnate. Boomtown. It didn't exist officially, and it had no name yet. But the Piper House was suddenly on a street, and the street had a name. Water Street. Materia hadn't been in a church since she'd got married. Now that there was a Catholic church right handy, there was no reason she couldn't just walk over. But she felt unworthy. Our Lady had not answered her prayer. Materia still did not love her child, and she knew the fault lay within herself. Kathleen, taille la hon. Materia sat the child on her lap and wrapped her arms around it. She sang, unrepeatable and undulating, Kan andi asafor, zarifu gandor, rasu ha hamar, sharu asfar, basa yunu sud, sud metlelel. Materia rocked the child and felt sad. Was that closer to love? She hoped. The child felt cool in her arms. I'll warm you, she thought, and kept singing. Kathleen stayed perfectly still, pressed close up against the rolling mass. Materia stroked the fire-gold hair and passed a warm brown hand across the staring green eyes. Kathleen tried not to breathe, tried not to understand the song. She tried to think of Daddy and light things, fresh air and green grass. She worried that Daddy would know and be hurt. There was a smell. Materia released the child. It was no good. God could not see past Materia's actions into her heart. And her heart was empty. Materia no longer went up to the hope chest to cry. She cried wherever she happened to be at the time, nor did it any longer interrupt her work or wrench a single muscle in her face. Give us a jawbreaker in a couple of honeymoons, said James. McIsaac's drugs and confectionery smelt of new pine, bitter herbs, and saltwater taffy. Mr. McIsaac reached into a tilted jar brimming with the edible rainbow. Behind him stretched shelf upon shelf of bottles and packets containing powders, essences, oils, and unguents. Whatever ails you. Mr. McIsaac handed Kathleen a sarsaparilla candy cane as an extra little treat. But she hesitated and looked at James, who said, It's all right, my darling. Mr. McIsaac's not a stranger. Mr. McIsaac looked at Kathleen gravely, lowered his head, and said, Go on, touch it. She touched his billiard-balled head and grinned. Mr. McIsaac said,
I hear you got a set of lungs on you, lass.
She nodded wisely, sucking on the candy cane. MacIsaac laughed, and James beamed. He and Kathleen left the shop together. Mrs. MacIsaac said from her perch on the sliding ladder, "She's beautiful."
"Yeah, she's a pretty little thing."
"Too pretty. They'll never raise her."
Mrs. MacIsaac watched the shop while Mr. MacIsaac limped back to his greenhouse for a drop of the good spirit. He'd been in the Boer War. At home, Materia stood at the counter rolling out dough for a pie. Steak and kidney like James's mother used to make. And finally twigged to a thing that had been nagging her all along. It was this. Kathleen's baptism hadn't taken. It had been done by a Protestant minister. The child needed to be properly baptized in Latin by a Catholic priest, and then everything would be all right. She told James when he arrived home with the girl, but he said, "Kathleen has been baptized. It was done by a man of the cloth, a Christian man, and that's all there is to it." Kathleen's cheeks bulged with hard candy, her green gaze directed up at her mother. She didn't look all that baptized to Materia. James had taught his daughter to read words soon after she learned to read music. At 3 1/2, she'd shared his lap with a terrifyingly illustrated book, more than half her size, and sounded out, "In the midway of this our mortal life, I found me in a gloomy wood astray." He'd started her on Latin when she was 5, teaching himself at the same time. It would help with her Italian singing. He ordered another box of books, children's classics this time, and they read them aloud, taking turns. He hadn't much time for his own reading, though his books now numbered 23, not counting the Encyclopedia Britannica. "Read that end to end," thought James as he gazed at his glass cabinet, "and you'd know just about everything. Go anywhere at all." At the local schoolhouse, Kathleen learned to sit in rows and not gawk at those less fortunate, but little else. The lady teacher got the creeps from the porcelain girl with the mermaid eyes. The child seemed to be in disguise, staring up at a corner of the ceiling or out the window, waiting for something, a sign, what, yet always ready with the answer.
"Wolf died on the plains of Abraham, miss."
Hands folded on the desk, spine straight.
"The square of the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the squares of the other two sides, miss."
Every feature formed to preternatural perfection.
"It's I before E, except after C, miss."
It wasn't right in a child. Perhaps she wasn't a child at all. In the schoolyard, Kathleen came alive, but in the oddest way, showing an alarming tendency to play with boys. Hurling soot balls, school bag raised as a shield, shrieking with joy in her linen sailor dress, ringlets flying, forever banishing herself from the society of girls. Blackened knees and torn silk were the stuff of high spirits, and James never scolded her for ruining her clothes. But when Kathleen came home and said,
"Pius McGillicuddy's got a finger in a jar what his da found in the mine that he's bought up from a wee tiny sprout,"
it was time to send her to Holy Angels in Sydney. The Sisters of the Congregation of Notre Dame were in the business of educating the whole girl, from grammar to botany, physics to French. But above all, Holy Angels offered an excellent music program. James had been going to wait a few years, till Kathleen turned 12 and he'd saved enough for tuition. But there was no help for it. She'd be tarnished by then. He'd find the money. He started a garden in the backyard on the far side of the creek. He bought a new old horse and cart. He traveled across the island to the Margery and collected topsoil with no trace of coal dust. The missus would have to learn to make soap and butter and her own clothes. From now on, they'd have to pay only for meat, and Benny always gave them a special price.
Benny gave James a special price on manure, too.
For you, free. That's kosher cow shit, mind you. You're going to have kosher carrots and potatoes. You'll be a Jew in no time. You want? I'll throw in a circumcision. No charge.
James went out to the woods and cut down a young apple tree, stripped it of branches, sharpened it at both ends, and drove it into the center of the garden, nailed a plank of driftwood across it, and dressed it in one of Materia's old frocks that she'd grown out of, and a fedora he found blowing over a field. It wasn't effective until he fashioned a head and torso from two flour sacks stuffed with straw to fill out the clothes, and impaled them on the stake. Every so often he changed its attire. Now a dress, now a pair of trousers. But always the hat, keeping the birds on edge.
Kathleen, come.
Materia no longer spoke Arabic to the girl. What for? Kathleen followed her mother into the kitchen. The big tin tub was full and steaming. Tomorrow was Kathleen's first day at Holy Angels, and James wanted her spick and span. That meant hair. Materia used to dread washing the child's hair because of all the fuss. James would holler from outside the kitchen door, "Are you trying to kill the poor child?" But Materia was used to the girl's hysterics, and performed the task briskly, scouring the scalp, dunking the head, wringing the tresses, getting the comb through, keeping her still. James could holler, but he would never intrude on his daughter's ablutions. This evening there were the customary protests.
"Don't pull! My eyes are stinging! Oh, oh! Stop it!"
But when Materia took Kathleen by the hair as usual and plunged her head backward for the first rinsing, she kept it under long enough to say into the submerged green eyes,
"Do you renounce Satan? Yes, and all his works. Yes. I baptize you in nomine Patris et Filii Spiritus Sancti. Amen."
There. In an emergency, any Catholic can baptize a child. And after 9 years, Materia considered it an emergency. Now the child would be safe. Now God could love her, even if Materia couldn't, and the nuns wouldn't think ill of her. Materia let go, and Kathleen's face broke the surface, gasping. Kathleen didn't cry or complain. She stood unwontedly docile as her mother toweled her dry, careful to attend roughly to the bad parts of the body. In the wee hours of that night, Kathleen woke up screaming. She was still screaming when her daddy picked her up, and she clung to him as he walked her up and down the hallway, struggling to make out what she was saying.
"Who's coming to get you?"
he asked. And when he had deciphered some more,
"Who's Pete?"
And she told him through her sobs. He carried her downstairs, out the kitchen door, across the coal clinks in the backyard, over the little footbridge to the garden, and right up to the scarecrow.
"Now, beat the can off him," James ordered.
Kathleen was shaking uncontrollably, almost gagging with fear. The scarecrow's hat cast a shadow over its featureless face. She couldn't see if it was smiling or frowning.
"Make a fist. Go on," said James.
She did, still crying.
"Now whack the bejesus out of him."
She struck out and knocked the scarecrow's head to the ground, hat and all.
"That's the stuff," said James,
and he tossed her into the air and caught her with a war whoop. Kathleen laughed as wildly as she'd been crying a moment before. It wound up in one of their yelling contests. Only there were neighbors now. And before long the lights came on in a nearby row of company houses, and cries of protest, obscene and otherwise, were raised. James replied at the top of his lungs,
"Shut up, the lot of you, and listen to this!"
And he had Kathleen sing, "Quanto affetto, quali cure, che te mette, padre mio? Lassù in cielo presso Dio veglia un angel protettor. Da noi toglie le sventure,
da mi madre il priego santo. Non fia mai divelto o franto questo a voi diletto fior.
That's how James got a reputation as a drinker, although at that point he was a teetotaler. The next day he stuck the straw head back onto the stake and jammed the hat on the head. There were no more nightmares. What great love, what care, what do you fear, my father? In heaven above, with God, I have a guardian angel. We are protected from all misfortune by the holy prayers of my mother. This flower that you love so much will never be uprooted or destroyed. The pit. Even though it was just an old cart, he painted it red with gold trim so she'd have something handsome to ride back and forth to school in. He did her initials in fancy gilt on the side, and their joke was, "Your carriage awaits without, ma'am." It meant giving up some piano pupils, but he drove her the 9 miles to Holy Angels every morning, and he was there every afternoon when the big double doors opened and she came running down the steps to meet him. On Friday afternoons they'd linger in Sydney, wandering down to the yacht club wharf to look at the ships in the harbor. "One day you'll get on one of those liners, my darling, and go." She wanted him to come with her, of course, but he didn't patronize her. "You're going to sing for people all over the world. I won't always be there, but it'll always be your daddy." At which she would cry, and he would take them for ice cream at Crown Bakery, her eyelashes still wet, but her eyes smiling once more. She never stayed sad for long. People stared wherever they went because she was beautiful, and the two of them were so obviously the best of friends. James knew that some day he'd have to hand her over to professionals, send her far away. But for now, there was a God. James consecrated his life to being a worthy caretaker of God's gift. It was how he could endure teaching the offspring of the petty bourgeoisie to mangle for a lease. "I'll do anything," he told God and himself. "I'll cut off my arm. I'll sell the teeth in my head. I'll enter the pit. I'll allow my wife to get a job."
"Okay," said Materia.
He prepared himself for the fact that she'd likely get work cleaning and cooking in someone else's house, or at a hotel. He told her to use her maiden name. "If people think you're married, they'll pay you less," he explained. It mustn't be known that Kathleen Piper's mother was a maid. Imagine his surprise when Materia left the house a few evenings later, wearing her good dress, her hair combed and done up under her hat. "Where are you going, Mrs.?"
"Work."
On Plummer Avenue, the main drag of the boomtown, inside the Empire Theater, the silver screen flickered, and down in the orchestra pit, so did the piano. Trills and triplets seemed a natural counterpart to the frenetic dance of light and shadow above. The audience leans slowly back as the locomotive appears on the horizon, tinkling toward them at first, birds singing, just another day in the country. Then the first hint of doom as the train looms larger, a switch from major to minor. Chugga, chugga, here it comes, rattling and rolling, whistle screeching, punctuated by the warning woo, woo, escalating through the landscape in a melody of mad elation, hurtling over the keys till all erupts in chaos. Notes and birds fly asunder, and the speeding iron horse thunders right over our heads and past us. The audience is breathless, eager for the next terror. All you can take for a nickel. Materia can't believe she's getting paid for this. The next scene is more terrifying. A man in evening clothes has cornered a young woman in a slinky nightgown halfway up a clock tower. No narrative preamble required. All ist klar.
The shadows lurk, the tower lists, the music creeps the winding stair. The villain spies a grace note of silken hem, and he's on the chase. In 6/8 time, up to where the heroine clings to a snatch of girlish melody, teetering on the precipice of high E, overlooking the street 8 octaves below. Villain struggles with virgin in a macabre waltz. Strauss turned Faust, until, just when it seems she'll plummet, dash her brains on the bass clef and die entangled in the web of the lower stave, a vision in tenor crescendos on to save the day in resolving chords. Before long, Materio was playing for local Kaylees and traveling vaudeville troupes. In December 1909, James boarded Kathleen at Holy Angels because children were dying in the boomtown. Scarlet fever, diphtheria, cholera, typhoid, smallpox, tuberculosis, leaving a wake of little white coffins. Outbreaks of disease were far from uncommon, but this was something else. This was an epidemic brought on by the miners' strike. Rows of company houses sat empty, their striking tenants evicted, yanked naked, some of them, pulled off the crapper and out of the cradle, credit cut off at the company store. Pinkerton guards and special company constables went door to door till there was more furniture on the streets than in the houses. Even miners who had bought their own homes were evicted, the coal company having put the fear of God into the mortgage company. Families hunkered down in ragged tent cities out in the fields. No running water, less food, scant shelter from the Atlantic winter winds. Scarlet blotches bloomed on the thin cheeks of children. They suffocated on pus, or died worn out from coughing. But nothing could convince the miners back to work. Not even a Royal Canadian machine gun mounted on the steps of the Immaculate Conception Church over at Cadogan Brook. And though Father Charlie MacDonald claimed he was away at the time, the Catholic Church did its bit all the same to end the needless suffering of the strike. The bishop sent a special envoy to the boomtown to empty the convent, the school, the rectory, and the church of the miners' families that the parish priest, Father Jim Fraser, was sheltering there. Then the bishop transferred Father Fraser right off the island. James acted fast. There was no money to board Kathleen at Holy Angels, but money would be found. She'd not be kept here in the boomtown to catch her death from the miners' brats, or wind up crippled or scarred in the face. Please, God, no. They've brought it on themselves, stubborn bastards. And that's why I have to bard my daughter at the school I really can't afford to send her to. And who's to help me do that? The Piano Teachers' Union? The Piano Tuners of the World Unite Party? Jesus Christ on the cross, no. I'm on my own. Sweetheart, you're going to live in at school for just a little while. She didn't want to. No, I won't be there, and it'll be a while before I can visit. He would observe strict quarantine. It'll be fun, you'll see. You'll make some buddies. She cried, he said, suddenly severe. Judita Pasta was lame, and when she was asked how she was able to sing so beautifully and act so brilliantly night after night, yet give no sign of her affliction, she said what?
It hurts.
He patted her on the head. That's the stuff. It would be months before he saw her again. He thought to himself, it's good training for the both of us. He took the ill luck the strike had dealt him and turned it to his own purposes. Before dawn one winter morning, he shouldered 3 sparkling new picks, an undented shovel, and a length of rope. He filled a teapot-style lamp with whale oil, clipped it to his peaked cap, hooked a lunch can to his belt, and walked with 3 Pinkerton guards to the number 12 gate, where khaki-clad Tommies guarded the coal with fixed bayonets. The soldiers who let him in were no friendlier than the gauntlet of striking miners he'd left outside, though the soldiers didn't spit or rave or call him scab and accuse him of murdering their children. Nor did they promise to throw his balls to the pigs. He entered the mouth of the pit, following the trembling light of the open flame at his forehead and the shadows of the man ahead, down the sloping shaft of the main deep along the rail tracks, reaching out to touch the steel rope now and then. The airless smell of ponies, damp wood and earth, through trap doors that swung open magically, it seemed, until a child's voice said,
"Hey, buddy, what's the time?"
Left turn, right, then left again, down, down through the maze of hollow branches that blossomed into dark chambers. He heard a bird chirping. Number 12 mine was terribly wet and gassy, but James had nothing to compare it to. He shoveled coal onto a cart in a dripping room he didn't know was under the ocean. He worked alongside one other man, who happened to be experienced. It was this man's job to undercut the wall, then bore and lay and light the charges without blowing up the mine. James couldn't place the man's accent, and never realized he was black, from Barbados, and just knew he was Albert, who never got them killed. Barbados, Italy, Belgium, Eastern Europe, Quebec. The Dominion Coal Company had reached far and wide to break the strike. Very few English voices in the darkness, and those that were there were heavily accented. James drank cold tea and chewed tobacco to keep down the dust, and at first concealed, then shared his meat sandwiches. The cart held just over a ton, and when it was full, he and Albert pushed it from the coal face to the headway and hitched it onto a trip. At the end of 10 hours, they surfaced into more darkness. The foreign men were escorted to their stockaded work camp nearby, called 14 Yard, to sing, sleep, or gamble, while the Royal Canadian Regiment stood guard. James walked home with the Pinkerton sons of bitches, passing between lines of mangy men who would have torn him limb from limb given half a chance. For as they saw it, James had no excuse. He wasn't starving, and he wasn't a foreigner. Past women who stood on front stoops and gave him the evil eye, muttering, "May God forgive you." One said a prayer for him, then hurled an iron doorstopper, missing him by a hair. James was making many times what he'd made teaching piano. For the first few weeks, he wept silently at the beginning of every shift, until his body got rebroken to the work. Every night at home, after he'd turned white again, he'd get on his knees, fold his hands, and beg his mother's forgiveness for going underground. The price of a song.
"You've got a bit thinner. That's good," James said to Materia over supper.
She shrugged.
"What are you daydreaming about?"
James used the term loosely. She was always gawping at everything and nothing.
"Houdini,"
she said.
"Who?"
"Houdini."
He didn't bother to pursue it. Ask a silly question. He'd long ago given up on conversation, and now merely thanked God that the idiocy and swarthiness had bypassed his daughter, and that his wife had learned to cook.
"What's this?"
"Kibanea."
"This a Hebrew delicacy?"
"Lebanese."
Benny had smuggled her the recipe. Anyone can make kibanea. Anyone can make anything by following directions. But to make it right, that takes a blessed finger. Some say it's in the length of the cook's fingers. Others claim it's in the scent, as unique as a fingerprint that every person carries. It is definitely a gift. Kibba was the national dish of Syria and Lebanon. It had to be made from the most trustworthy meat. Therefore, the Mahmouds bought only from Lvovitz's kosher Canadian butcher shop. While Mrs. Lvovitz and the boys minded the shop, Benny made his deliveries in Sydney, always going last to the Mahmoud house on the hill. There, a dark little round woman with a graying bun of black hair would open the kitchen door to him. Benny didn't speak Gaelic, and Mrs. Mahmoud's English was still halting,
but they managed to chat. Benny would go along with the pretense that Mrs. Mahmood's interest in the Piper family was purely casual.
"Oh, sure, I know the Pipers. She's a nice lady, Mrs. Piper. Lebanese, too. I guess you must know her, no? Ah, well, yes, they've got a lovely daughter, Kathleen. Goes to Holy Angels. Sings like a bird."
And this morning, when Benny asked Mrs. Mahmood for the kibbeh recipe, "For my wife," she didn't raise an eyebrow, but went immediately to her cupboards and pointed out ingredients. Benny noted it all on brown butcher paper as Mrs. Mahmood mimed the whole process, including the imprinting of a cross on the prepared meat. Benny laughed and shook his head and drew a Star of David for her instead. Mrs. Mahmood shrugged and said, "What do you like?" and gave him the ritual first taste of the imaginary kibbeh.
"Delicious," he said.
That evening, Mrs. Mahmood watched her husband eat and thought of her lost daughter, perhaps even now serving the same dish to her own husband. Would he appreciate it? Did he love her still? 9 miles away, James took a forkful of kibbeh and ate.
"It's delicious."
"Eat with bread."
He followed Materia's example, drizzling oil over the spiced meat and soft cracked wheat, tearing off bits of flat bread, folding the meat into mouthfuls.
"Where'd you learn to cook this?"
"Isra, no cook."
He paused.
"Kosher?"
She nodded. He resumed eating.
Materia got a pang. She thought, "We're happy without the girl."
She touched the back of his neck lightly.
"What are you doing?" he said.
"Nothing."
And she returned to the sink. Up till now, the vaudevillians had been white, doing their minstrel shows and pickaninny turns in blackface. But now that there was a colored migration to the Sydney coal field, genuine colored artists started coming up from the States. Materia couldn't figure out why they, too, performed under cork with giant painted-on mouths. But she did know she preferred them. She acquired a big collection of ragtime, two-step, cakewalk, processionals, sorrow songs, plantation lullabies, and gospel. She got to play for the Blackville Society Tap Twizzlers when their own accompanist was arrested in Glace Bay. They were a trio of brothers managed by their mother. The eldest had named his feet. He called the left one Alpha and the right one Omega. Percussive shoes, flashing feet that chatted, clattered, took flight and girdled the globe without ever leaving center stage at the Empire Theater. Materia just watched their feet and let her hands go, chunks of Rigoletto colliding with coal-black rose, una voce poco fa on a seesaw with jimmy-crack corn, all slapped up against her own spontaneous compositions, just as for the moving pictures. Only with the dancers, there was a two-way feed. They hounded, flattered, talked back and twisted. Ebony, ivory, and nickel clickers grappling until there wasn't even any melody, just rhythm and attitude. Materia became a bit of a celebrity, especially among the young folk.
"Hey there, Materia. How's she going, girl?"
"That's Mrs. Piper to you, buddy,"
James shot back. It was a Sunday in March. They were out whitewashing the house. He turned to Materia when the feller had slunk by.
"How do you know him?"
"The show."
The Blackville Society Tap Twizzlers invited her to tour with them as their permanent accompanist. They were going to Europe. Materia said no. She cried on the way home at the thought of how happy she and James could be, seeing the world together with a traveling show. But she knew better than to ask him. The colored artists stopped coming soon after, because word had gone down the line that the new arrivals in Sydney Coalfield were up from the West Indies and weren't too interested in American colored entertainment.
but Materia still had the vaudeville and the picture shows, and she was happy as long as she could play. Down in the orchestra pit, she consoled herself with the occasional embellishment. Now and then, a locomotive sped toward the audience through I Love You Truly, and ran over them to Moonlight Sonata. Villains struggled with virgins to the wedding march, and tenors saved the day to Turkey and the Straw. Performers complained, but the audience ate it up when rabbits emerged from top hats to discordant splats, and women were sawn in half to Nearer My God to Thee. Materia had always smiled as she played, but now she started chuckling, though she wasn't aware of it. This further endeared her to the audience, who liked her all the better for being a bit loony. These days, James went all the way to Sydney for provisions. With the exception of Benny and Mr. McIsaac, he didn't darken the door of any boomtown establishment. Why go in to be insulted when he was paying good money? The whole town was suffering as a result of the strike, not just the miners, so everyone loved to hate a scab. He never walked. He drove his cart so as not to give people the satisfaction of crossing the street when they saw him coming. And all because I have the gumption to support my family. It was galling, therefore, on the rare occasion when Materia accompanied him to hear time and again, "Hello there, Materia. How's the show business, dear?" The same people who wouldn't give him the time of day would stop to chat with his illiterate wife about her career as a player piano. Naturally, these people would appreciate a low type of music. And why were they out spending money they supposedly didn't have on the price of admission at the Empire Theater? There were too many Irish in this town by now for James's liking. Every second house a shebeen, drunken Catholics the lot. If they worked more and fiddled less, they wouldn't be in such a mess. James thought of Aesop's grasshopper and ant, and made a mental note to enclose the fable in his next letter to Kathleen. Picking up a packet of starch at McIsaac's, James had to endure, "You've got a very talented wife, Mr. Piper." James paid. McIsaac continued, "And how's the wee lass?" "She's all right. She's got a gift, that one." James nodded. McIsaac smiled and added, "Gets it from her mother, no doubt." James turned and left the store. He wouldn't be taking Kathleen in there again. He decided he didn't trust the bald man. He didn't like the way he looked at children with his watery blue eyes and his big red face. If McIsaac liked children so much, why didn't he have any of his own? When James left, Mrs. McIsaac said to her man, "We shouldn't let Piper set foot in here." McIsaac smiled softly at his wife, then retired to his greenhouse. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Everyone liked McIsaac, though not everyone understood how he could tolerate a man like Piper. But McIsaac didn't see the point in penalizing a man's family for a man's mistakes, and that was what you did when you cut a feller off. People shrugged and figured maybe McIsaac was just religious. And he was, in a way. He spent a lot of time finding medicine out in the fields where other people saw only stones and scrub. He cultivated the plants in his greenhouse. Never called in a debt. Pity about the drink. At the end of that week, James sat down to his latkes and molasses and said, "I want you to quit your job now, missus. I'm earning enough at the pit." No answer. He looked up. Hard to know sometimes if she even registered a word he said. "Did you hear me?"
"Okay."
"And don't be traipsing around town on your own." How unhappy are they who have a gift that's left to germinate in darkness. The pale plant will sink invisible roots and live whitely off their blood. The first week away from the Empire was hardest. The empty house, and at night James, who required feeding and nothing else. She searched for the key to the piano, and finally pried the instrument open with a knife. But after a few numbers, she fell silent. She needed a stage, not a garret. No audience, no show. Materia took her sheaf of music and put it in the hope chest. She cleaned the house and cooked a lot. Ate. She didn't have the heart to spend much time with Mrs. Lvovitz because the boys, Abe and Rudy, were a reproach to her soul. How could it be that she loved another woman's children and not her own? The interlude at the Empire receded and became unreal. Now that Materia was on her own again, with plenty of time to think, all her badness rolled back in and enveloped her. To have left her father's house, to have disobeyed and dishonored her parents, that was against the commandments.
I have to go to confession, she thought. But then, in order to be forgiven, I must be heartily sorry. But to be sorry for eloping means to be sorry for everything that came from it.
And she couldn't be. She still wanted her husband, and that, too, was a sin. To want the man and not the child that comes from the marital act. And so she would keep coming back to her original sin. She resumed her prayers to the Blessed Virgin. It pierced her heart, and it seemed a dreadful vapor rose from the wound when she realized she hadn't given a thought to her daughter all this time. Not a note had she sent, no package of goodies from home. She hadn't even asked James, "How's the girl?" Materia saw herself in a clear glass at last, and it was monstrous. Whom could she tell? No one. Yet she must tell or die. In the second week, Materia left the house and walked to the cliff, but didn't linger there as she used to. She scrambled down to the rocky shore and walked. She didn't sing. She talked and talked in her mother tongue to the stones, till she grew dizzy and the day grew gray, and she lost track of where she was. Finally, as sometimes happens in this part of the world, the clouds lifted. A burning sky lit the sea in rippling tongues of red and gold. Materia fell silent. She faced the horizon and listened until she heard what the sea was saying to her. "Give it to me, my daughter, and I will take it and wash it and carry it to a far country until it is no longer your sin, but just a curiosity adrift, beached and made innocent." And so, day after day, Materia slowly let her mind ebb away, until she was ready to part with it once and for all.
Quanto dolor. I'm very fond of dividing and classifying and examining. You see, I'm so much alone. I've so much time for reflection. And Papa is training me to think. Claudia by A.L.O.E. The strike ended in April 1910, and James got a job on the surface as a check weighman in reward for his loyalty. He had expected to see his pit buddy Albert up there, too. Had hoped to get a look at him in the light of day, but Albert had been let go. He had moved on to Sydney with many others from 14 Yard, and settled in Whitney Pier in the neighborhood known as the Coke Ovens. There were lots of people up there from the West Indies. The Dominion Iron and Steel Company knew the value of a strong man who could stand heat. The Coke Ovens was a cozy community. Its houses painted everything but white, snuggled right up against the steel mill. The mill put bread on the table and a fine orange dust on the bread. In the boom town, the company houses were tenanted once more. The company store took miners' scrip again. The last children were buried, and Kathleen came home. James had a surprise waiting. Electric lights and a modern water closet complete with indoor toilet, enamel tub and nickel-plated taps, hot and cold. But with his hours at the pit head, James could no longer drive Kathleen to and from Holy Angels. He hired a fellow from the coke ovens, who drove his own horse and buggy. James was taken aback by his youth. Leo Taylor was barely 16, but he was steady. James made sure. "No detours. Straight there and straight home."
"Yes, sir."
"I don't want you talking to her."
"No, sir."
"Don't touch her."
"I wouldn't."
"I'll kill you."
"Don't worry, sir."
James reflected that he'd rather have a timid youth drive his daughter than a leering man. The fact that Taylor was colored made James feel all the more confident of the necessary distance between driver and passenger. Although she no longer had any buddies in the boomtown, Kathleen was relieved to be living at home again. Boarding at Holy Angels had been lonely. At first, she'd cried herself to sleep, comforted only by the notes and treats that her daddy sent. But she knew that sacrifices were being made, knew what was expected of her, didn't flinch. She studied hard, obeyed the nuns and never complained, though she did pray for a fairy godmother to send her a friend, for there was no one to play with at Holy Angels. No boys, no cinders embedded in her knees. Other little girls weren't interested in sword fights and adventure, or in who can enact the most spectacular death scene. Other girls were preoccupied with meticulous feminine arcana, of which Kathleen knew nothing. What was more, none of them had careers. Initially, her schoolmates had vied for Kathleen's friendship. She was so pretty, so smart. But she failed to decode pecking orders, declined gracious invitations to braid other girls' hair, and made a lasso of the skipping rope. They put her down as odd until, finally, they shunned her altogether. Kathleen threw herself into her work and cultivated an insouciant nonconformity. Her sash low slung and tied in front, hat pushed back, hands gemmed into the pockets that she ordered her mother to sew into her uniforms, her long hair waving loose. The nuns made allowances. She had a gift. In the fall of 1911, they sailed to the mainland. James, Kathleen, and her singing teacher, Sister St. Cecilia, to a recital at the Royal Conservatory of Music in Halifax, an invited audience of professionals.
"Look me in the eyes."
She did. He invoked the spirits.
"What did Stendhal say of Elisabetta Gaffarini?"
"Whether you see or only hear her, your peril is the same."
"That's the stuff."
His usual affectionate bonk on the head.
"Now, go out there and show 'em who's boss."
Kathleen sang Cherubino's love poem to Susanna from Le Nozze di Figaro. Teachers from New York City gave James their cards. They were looking for the next Emma Albani. Told him what he already knew. Henriette Sontag debuted at 6. Maria Malebran at 5. Adelina Patti was younger every year, her legend already way ahead of her mortality. But James was so serious about Kathleen's career that he could wait for it to begin. Patience is the mark of the true player. Her voice would last, not burn out in a blaze of adolescent glory. He would send her to Halifax for a year to get her sea legs, then on to Milano at 18. Kathleen turned 12.
When Malibran's father told her she must go on for Giuditta Pasta as Desdemona to his Otello, he looked her in the eye and swore that if she did not sing perfectly,